Well, welcome to this afternoon's section. To make sure you're in the right place, the official title is Resist in Solidarity Against Our Top-Heavy Economic System, featuring Chuck Collins, who's here, and Richard Wolff, Professor Richard Wolff, who unfortunately could not make it. So the program will not include Richard Wolff. But the outline of the program is that three of our board members from UU's for Just Economic Community will ask three questions of Chuck Collins, and then he'll have about 25 minutes to weave those answers to those questions and his own into his own presentation. And I think you will really appreciate his skills as a speaker. Then for another 25 minutes or so, we'll have an opportunity for question and answer between you, the audience, and Chuck. And there'll be a little microphone back there. And for the last 15 or 20 minutes, we'll gather into small groups of your neighbors and ask you to tell each other about what you're doing about the issue or what questions, so we can you have some way to express yourself. And maybe later, if you want to, you can send some feedback to us, because we'd like to hear also what you're doing. And we have an email at uujc.com. It's called uujc@uujec.com. And so I'm Dick Burkhart, one of the board members of uujc.com. And we are the ones who actually put together the study action issue on escalating inequality. And there's going to be a vote on that tomorrow on the statement of conscience. And we're not, frankly, very happy with the statement of conscience, the way it's worded, or even the way it will be amended. And we're asking for delegates to vote to table that so we can come back and do a much better job next year. And so my lead-off question to Chuck is going to relate to that. As you all know, we had an upset in the last presidential election, Donald Trump. There's not been much talk about that at this GA. I want to start that talk. I want to think about how do we strategize beyond Trump, but in terms of inequality, why did Trump really get elected? What were the root causes, the driving things, the underlying factors that led to his election? And are we addressing those? What can we do about it? How can we strategize? And Chuck has some ideas on that. And Terry, would you like to ask your question? Terry Lohman is another one of our board members.
My question is, can you help inform us? You can't hear you? Okay. Can you help inform us about all the hidden ways, or it can't be all, but many of the hidden ways that the 1% are taking advantage of our system and how we have affirmative action for the wealthy people? The distribution of where the government's money goes, it's something like 40% goes to the top 10%, or maybe it's even more than that. It's a huge part of the government funding.
My name's Sky Stewart, and my question is about, well, at this GA, we've been talking a lot about racial justice, and you may have noticed that sometimes people use discussion of economic inequality and economic injustice as a way to turn away from racial justice. So how do we make a conversation about economic justice that is really justice for everybody who is suffering economically, regardless of other intersectional factors?
So you're on, Chuck. Okay. Chuck would introduce himself. Well, I'll say a few things first, but he's a longtime UU. He's at the Institute for Policy Studies now as director of the program on inequality and the common good. Written many books. He's worked with Bill Gates Sr. on retaining a campaign to retain our estate tax. And he's got a very special background I'm sure he'll tell you about.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming with all the amazing offerings this afternoon. Thank you for being here. So I'm Chuck Collins. I live in Boston. I'm a member of First Church UU Jamaica Plain. But I know a number of people here because in the last year I've been on the road. I have this book out called Born on Third Base. So I've been in some of your communities, and there's a UUJEC table over here, by the way, that has some information about this work that we're doing and about the book and other things. And tomorrow at 10:30, I'm doing a book event at the UU bookstore. That's all. And I want to thank UU's for Just Economic Community for holding this discussion, continuing to kind of put forward these issues of inequality. This group of people and members of UUJEC got the Escalating Inequality Study Action Resolution. Many congregations have had forums and study groups and book discussions and movies, and many of you have been part of that. So congratulations to this work. And I just would not underestimate the power of UUs in our communities to kind of move this discussion along. So thank you for all that work that you've done. So I was born on third base. I'm the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So my father used to say bringing home the bacon means something different in our family. I have Wisconsin bratwurst heritage, hot dogs and all that. So part of the perspective I bring is somebody who grew up in the 1%, who for the last 25 years has been working on these issues of inequality. I made a handout, but I only made about 150 copies of it. So I'm happy to send it digitally to anybody. There's a clipboard over there, and actually we could circulate that clipboard, just because some of the hyperlinks in it may be useful to you. But let me start off by just, you know, in a couple minutes, I want to set the stage for a discussion, address some of the questions that some of the members mentioned and raised, and I'm curious if people can hear me okay. Sort of a strange sound system from here. Okay, so I assume you're here because you've noticed we're living in a period of extreme inequality, that the concentrations of wealth and power are pretty much unprecedented in our lifetimes, unless you were alive in 1916. Anyone here alive in 1916? No? Okay. So it's safe to say we are at the most unequal point in history in our lifetime. And part of that story is that real wages have been flat for 40 years. The bottom half of the population has not shared in the growth of the economy for four decades. That is one of the reasons why I think the results of the election emerged the way they did. Rising inequality has created a sense of betrayal, of people being left behind, of anger. And that's not just in rural white communities. Those are in urban centers across race and class, that dynamic of people being left behind. And I think that is the moment that we're living in. The other part of the dynamic is that the concentration of wealth is dizzying, right? So we used to say the 99 to 1. Remember the 99 to 1. But actually, most of the income and wealth gains of the last decade, since the economic meltdown, have gone to the top 1/10 of 1%. And the more you go up the ladder, the more concentrated wealth becomes. The richest 400 people have as much wealth as the bottom 62% of society. The richest 100 billionaires in the United States have as much wealth as the entire African American community in the United States, 14 million households. The richest 20 enough that could fit on one Gulfstream 650 jet, have as much wealth as the bottom half of all households. And that is because the number of households who have zero or negative net worth continues to rise. So this is the issue of our time. And when we think about race and the racial wealth divide and the trajectory of where we're going, we've done some studies that look at over the next 30 years, if we just don't intervene in these cycles of inequality, that we will become an economic and racial apartheid society, that the racial wealth divide will double over the next 30 years, that we will become, as Thomas Piketty says, a society governed by a hereditary aristocracy of wealth, where the sons and daughters of today's billionaires dominate our politics, our culture, philanthropy, and the economy. So that's the moment we're in. And I assume that you're here because you want to talk about what do we do about that? And what is it that we can do in different ways? One other challenge, and I'll just flag this because it's something that I've been working a lot recently, is huge amounts of wealth are now being hidden. So I just reported the statistics on what we know. But we just learned that really households with $40 million or more are probably hiding about a third of their wealth either in offshore tax havens or in trusts where they don't have to report where the money is. And so huge, as inequality grows and wealth concentrates at the top, so does the amount of money that disappears. Think of it as wealth as a giant reservoir, a deep lake. And we draw out of that lake the money that we need for taxes and public services, but the level of the lake keeps going down. And there's a pipe that goes off into the woods. And the water is being drained away. And we're being told there's not enough money, and we have to tighten our belts, and we have to take shorter showers, and we have to have middle-class tax increases when huge amounts of wealth now is being siphoned off. So part of the work we have to do is to close up the hidden wealth loopholes that are draining the swamp, if draining the reservoir. So why does this relate to Dick's question that we, you know, the election we had? I think the election was about inequality. I just came back from England, where clearly this wave of populism, this sort of growing inequality, which is a global dynamic, is giving rise to both regressive populism and progressive populism. So it gives rise to sort of a Trump, a politics of deflection, shifting the blame onto others, new immigrants. It's sort of the history of anti-Semitism, the great deflection. It's the oldest story in the book, really. Inequality grows, instability grows, let's blame somebody who's more vulnerable. But it also has given rise to progressive populism, sort of the Bernie Sanders movement and others who talked about how the concentration of wealth and corporate power is undermining that which we care about. And I think that it's important to remember in this moment when we're just sort of reeling each day from the latest Trump assault. I mean, just reading about the Senate healthcare bill today, just, you know, wrenching to think that this could become, some part of this could be the law of the land. That's what we are holding each day. But I want us all to remember that there is good news, which is there is a realignment happening that has to do with these inequalities, and that the Trump program of healthcare and tax cuts is not going to address the underlying drivers of these extreme inequalities, and so the pressure will continue to build. And that is both the danger and the opportunity that we have. So what's great about UUJEC and this group is we want to talk about what are the drivers of these inequalities and how we can address them. And I think there's sort of several arenas that we want to talk about. What is it we do? Well, there is the policy work. There's the campaigns. There's the issue work. There's stopping the bad and moving where we can. Then there is the deeper work of the stories that hold these inequalities in place, the narratives that justify inequality, whether it's racial wealth disparities, racial inequality, or economic and class inequality. And finally, there's the work, the spiritual work, if you will, of breaking open hearts and minds to make these changes. I'm going to talk a bit mostly about the public policy work, but I'm obviously, the book that I did, Born on Third Base, is really a book about how do we interrupt the narratives that hold inequality in place. But in the handout that I shared, and I'm not assuming everyone has it, I think that it's important to say, you know, we have, at the federal level, we have things we have to stop. We have to stop this bad healthcare bill. This bad healthcare bill is almost entirely driven by a tax cut agenda. The reason why the Republicans are moving so fast to move this bill secretly, a bill that only 20% of the population supports, that will throw tens of millions of people off of health insurance, that will reverse the slight bit of progress we've made on health equity. The driver, the motivation, is the tax cut agenda. They believe that if they can get $1 trillion in savings by cutting taxes for the rich in the healthcare bill, that they'll be able to add that savings to other savings they want to make and be able to provide a whopper tax cut, primarily for households with incomes over $250,000. That is the motivation. Healthcare policy is not the motivation. It's the tax cut agenda. And so it's important that we basically be out there wherever we are, including today, calling your senators, whoever they are, and just saying, this is an abomination, stop. Because gridlock right now is actually the name of the game. We just want to stop that. Because if you stop the healthcare, it actually slows down and gums up the tax cut agenda. But we have to be ready for that tax cut agenda as well if it should come down the rails. And that's where there are fights like defending the estate tax, defending the most progressive elements of our tax code. There's a website, defendestatetax.com. There's a place to plug in. So there is defensive work. But it's also very important to look at where we can move, particularly in states and cities and localities. And in this handout, I sort of identify some of the places that people are doing that. Anybody in the House from Portland, Oregon? Okay, Portland, Oregon passed an ordinance in November to charge a higher tax on corporations that have a large gap between their highest and average workers. So the city of Portland basically said, if you're going to pay your, yeah, Portland, you're going to pay your CEO 100 times more than your average worker, you're going to have to pay a higher municipal tax. And there's 700 companies that are mostly transnational companies that will have to do that in the city of Portland. All of a sudden, that idea got picked up by about 35 other jurisdictions. Other cities and states have introduced ordinances and legislation. Similarly, states are looking at revenue. The state of California is looking at a state inheritance tax, a state wealth tax. There's overwhelming support, by the way, for those initiatives. So those are, and there are 32 states that lost their state-level inheritance taxes that are looking at ways to bring them back and link them to something that they care about, like debt-free education, tuition-free education. So part of the work is stopping the bad. Part of the work is looking for opportunities to where we can move in states and localities. And part of it is to seed big ideas anticipating a political realignment. And here's why I think it's possible that this realignment may happen. As I said, I just came back from England, And you can recall that the UK had a moment, which is they had their Trump moment, which is they passed this Brexit vote, a regressive populist response to economic inequality and economic change. And the Conservatives in power, Theresa May, 2 months ago, said, I'm going to call an election because the Labour Party is polling at 24%, and we're gonna clean house. We're going to take more power, consolidate Conservative power, and be able to run our agenda. And what happened is that the Labour Party, but the grassroots, the equivalent really of grassroots movements like Move On and Our Revolution and some of the formations here in this country, there's a group called Momentum, which basically organized 150 committees around the country to door knock, educate, engage with voters, get out the vote. And out of the 60 swing districts, the Labor won 56 of them and almost basically knocked the Conservative governing coalition. So it's a really very relevant case study to the United States right now, which is if you look at the undercurrents. I have this quote from Election Day. 75% of, somebody's getting a call. Maybe somebody's speaker phone from last session or something. 75% of voters on election night told Reuters that what they want, America needs a strong leader to take the country back from the rich and powerful. Think about that. So are they getting what they wanted? Not necessarily here. And I think that there are obviously states and pockets and voters who will stand with their candidate for a while. But the undercurrent, what happened in England is that everyone else got mobilized. And I think that's the good news here, is there is a wakening up. There is a resistance emerging around this country that's taking all kinds of forms. And if you think about where we were 5 years ago or 6 years ago compared to now, there is a level of engagement that is rising. And younger people under 35, are highly engaged and politicized in this moment. And similar to what happened in England. So it wasn't necessarily that people changed their mind, people who voted for Brexit then voted for Jeremy Corbyn. It's that the Corbyn forces and everyone else who were sitting things out mobilized. And that actually made a huge difference. So I think we should, and particularly younger voters and younger activists. So I think that is just something we should keep in mind as we look at this moment that we're in. Sky asked the question, I think, you know, when I think about this beautiful General Assembly we're having and how we're struggling with race and the intersection of all the isms and what is it, just here's one way to think about it, is I think we should be holding all of this, what we're experiencing, to understand the legacy of white supremacy and how that has unfolded and how that impacts us in every way. And one way I like to think about it is the inequalities of the last 40 years have supercharged the historic legacies of racial and inequality. So it's almost like two different strands of history that are woven together that cannot be pulled apart. We like to try to think, okay, there's racial justice and economic justice. It is totally interwoven. And we need to have solutions that are not race blind, right? So some people said, you know, when Bernie Sanders first ran, there was a sort of way in which he talked that was speaking to the white working class but wasn't addressing the deeper legacy of white supremacy. We have to do that. We have to do that in a way that, you know, recognizes that the solutions are not going to be The solution to reducing concentrations of income and wealth inequality may or may not also reduce the racial disparities. And likewise, things that focus entirely on race may not get at the drivers of these larger forces. You know, we're living at a time of extreme extractive capitalism globally that's tearing communities apart, that's hoovering up wealth from every pocket of the commons and individual workers, and it's having a kind of multiplier impact where existing inequalities already existed. So I think that we should hold and embrace the complexity of these intersections. How do these forces of economic inequality impact the historic, centuries-old racial wealth disparities? What are the solutions that do that? So Terry asked an interesting question. How does this tax system help the 1%? Well, here's an interesting thing. We have a system of subsidies that are completely upside down. We spend $600 billion a year in tax breaks to help people build wealth in this society. Almost all of them go to wealthy households and white households. These are existing, like the home mortgage interest deduction, like the deduction for property taxes, like some of the retirement fund, design of the retirement funds. These are upside down subsidies that mostly benefit the affluent. Most of the dollar benefits go to the top. So, you know, we could actually redesign things to focus those resources on those who have been excluded from wealth building. And this is where I think we do have to talk about reparations. Reparations for the African American as well as for First Nations. And, you know, we should be saying, as our just economic justice work, is we want to have pass H.R. 40, you know, to create a study commission to explore the legacy of slavery and on our economy, and formulate proposals for reparations. And we should do the same with First Nations. So I think that doesn't have to it doesn't have to divide us. It is important to talk about the concentration of wealth and power, though, in the context of dealing with racial disparities. You know, we're talking about concentrations mostly of white-owned wealth. And we might be able to design campaigns that tax wealth at the top and invest in first-time homebuyer or wealth-building accounts or things that actually reduce the racial wealth divide very, very directly. So I think that that's a piece of the work. Let me stop there, but, you know, and I think I'm open to questions, and I think if there are questions for UUJEC going forward, I think that would be important. I welcome you, encourage you to check out inequality.org, which is sort of the web portal, and I send out every Monday a little newsletter that we call it the hope, the horror, and the humor of the moment we're in. So, of course, there's the horror of the inequalities we're living in, but there's also the hope, the examples of the work that people are doing every day, and we try to bring a little bit of humor to that, too. So check out inequality.org and the newsletter.
Yeah. Thank you.
Before our first question, I want to remind you about Chuck's book, Born on Third Base. He was born on third base, but he did not stay there. He gave away his wealth and devoted his life to justice. But he knows how to talk to the wealthy and the poor. He works with the both. He covers the whole spectrum. And there'll be a book signing 10:30 tomorrow morning in the UA bookstore if you'd like to get his book. I've read it and been to it. I'm glad I'm at his third presentation now, and I love each one even more than the last. So we're lining up now. Let's have our first question for Chuck.
Okay. Is this on?
Okay.
I wanted to address that question about discussing economic matters is not the same as helping our situation, racism, which is, racism is such a difficult topic. Well, today Trump signed a bill that says that we could, fire any employee of the VA without him having a review. This is part of the privatization in the VA. There is nothing more important to brown and black veterans than the VA, which is the only single-payer healthcare system in this country that's worth a damn, and they're about to destroy it. If you want to be pro-black people, brown people, you support the VA, and you support other systems, like the educational system that's being destroyed, putting preschool back into the education system. You have to work through economics to help the black and brown people in this country.
I would just say similar to Medicaid. Medicaid, you know, there's so many things that are talked about as universal, but reduce racial disparities in health. So the attack on the Affordable Care Act is going to reverse 6 years of gains in terms of health equity. Yeah, Art.
Good to see you again, Chuck.
Yes. Speak right into that. Eat the microphone, as they say.
I think we can get a little bit closer here. He talked about black and brown people and older people. And okay, how about that?
Perfect.
Okay. Eat the microphone, as they say. Yeah.
Well, the last speaker spoke about the black and brown people, but I would like for you to elaborate more on the impact of everyone in this room with this upside down process and taxations and benefits. The local organizations in every community is impacted in terms of voting systems, education, and police. Would you, or justice system, would you please elaborate a bit on that?
Well, I think they're probably even better resource people in other sessions happening here, just looking at the criminal justice system, how that layers onto these historic inequalities. But I think that that's just as we understand that there are these different threads, we call it intersectionality, but different experiences, different histories coming together in this present moment, and how the accumulation. We're living in a time where advantages for the top are compounding, and disadvantages or barriers are also compounding. There's a new book out by Richard Reeves called Dream Hoarders, which is looking at the top 10% and how basically people help their children. But by helping your children economically, while we disinvest public investments in social opportunity, creates a dynamic where one segment of people like me, born on third base, are delinking and having accumulating advantages, and there are these historic compounding disadvantages as well.
Hi, Chuck. I'm Jim Reeder from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Fort Wayne, Indiana. At the beginning of your talk, you gave us a lot of numbers and statistics. We get those every day from our government. Could you tell us where you get your numbers? I'm sure you don't just get them from Rachel.
Well, I would. We basically are drawing on the growing body of research, not just on inequality, but why it matters, why it's touching every aspect of our lives. And I think the shortcut is I would encourage people to visit inequality.org and look at the data portal. So there's some data sheets. If you're giving a presentation or a workshop and you want to have, you know, inequality, different dimensions, both the racial dimensions of it, the gender dimensions, if you want to understand how these inequalities are playing out, just visit that resource. Yeah.
Dan Griffith from Lexington, Massachusetts. And following a demonstration at the Massachusetts State House, I suffered a massive heart attack and stroke, and I was discharged to a rehab hospital where I spent the several weeks with Trump voters watching the Democratic convention, I was supposed to avoid stress, and most of the hospital workers were Trump voters. So I understand why they did what they did with some precision. And I would caution that we all, as progressives, need to watch our language. I am a dangerous person because I am a 60s radical. I've committed more felonies probably than anybody in this room. And I will tell you that I also can tell you how to document a credit default swap. I've worked in the belly of the capitalist beast as a successful corporate lawyer. And so I will say that the three books that I would recommend people read, Don't Think of an Elephant, because we have to, as progressives, stop using language talking to one another. Two is Paul Krugman's Conscience of a Liberal, that traces the history of how Republicans get people to vote against their interest. And Frank Luntz's Words Matter, which is where Frank opens the kimono about how the Republicans succeed in getting people to vote for people who will screw them. So I would say be very careful when we use the word reparations or other things, because we build into the frames that our opposition uses against us.
I'm glad you rebounded so well. And you're fighting the good fight. And I would add two other books to your list. One is Joe Bejant wrote a great book called Deer Hunting with Jesus, which is about the white working class. And it's about his answer to, because he would hear, you know, liberal folks saying, why is it people vote against their interests? And he says, here's my answer to that. And it's really very, very insightful. So I recommend it. And then Arlie Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land. And I think that the one takeaway is, I think you're right. When talking about reparations, you know, I have done that on conservative talk radio shows actually in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and places like that. And nothing kind of sets people off if you talk about privilege to people who don't feel they have an experience of privilege. And I think part of the work is to understand, again, going back to the beginning of what I said, half the population has not seen their real incomes go up in 40 years, and they have been feel left behind. And some of those folks are here in this room, and some of them are not. But you know, that is the underlying wound, if you will. And if we can't speak and address that underlying wound, we're not going to be able to have a conversation. We're not, you know. And Arlie Hochschild's point is, you know, think of, you know, she was at, you know, think of the voters. She was in Louisiana, embedded, you know, with the Tea Party there, and she created a parable. We like parables, right? Created a parable for understanding how the Trump voters feel, the Tea Party voters feel. She said, imagine you're standing in a line going up a hill, and the line is to get to the American dream. And you're waiting in line patiently, and you have worked hard in your life, and you've made sacrifices. You may have served in the military, but you're standing in this line, and the line is stalled out. In fact, it's moving backwards. And then you're told that people are cutting in line in front of you. And then you're told that at the head of the line is Barack Obama, who's encouraging all these people to cut in line, and they're new immigrants, and they're people of color, and it's not that you resent people of color, you just don't like it when people cut in line. That's how they're feeling, right? That's the emotional experience. And then, you know, if you complain about that, people say, well, you're a racist. And you're like, hey, look, I work and live with people, alongside people of color, I just don't like people cutting in line. And then along comes Donald Trump, or along comes the Tea Party, and they say, we see you standing in that line, and we're going to do something about it. And all of a sudden, that sense that you're invisible and that you're a stranger in your own land, somebody is speaking to that. So what's the lesson for us? One lesson is we got to get the line moving again, because stagnant wages and inequality are the breeding ground for populist resentment, whether it's regressive or progressive. Second is we need to empathize. Empathize is hard for some folks to hear that, but hear that, at least understand the experience of people enough so by engaging. And third is we need to do campaigns that can unite people, you know, across differences, progressive populist campaigns. And the good news is raising the minimum wage, 70-80% of voters support that. Taxing the wealthy, eliminating college debt, broader health insurance for all, these are all broadly supported ideas where there is a basis for a progressive populist platform. And that's what the Jeremy Corbyn, you know, momentum movement in England did. They just picked some things that really were able to shift the balance. So I think that's part of our challenge. I see you in line, as they say.
Hey, sir, thank you. My name is Tony LeVar. You all hear me? No. Thanks, Mike. My name is Tony LeVar. Okay. I live in San Antonio, Texas. I'm a member of the First UU in San Antonio, Texas. Can you all hear me now? Very good. Thanks. Okay. Thanks, buddy. Okay. Bernie Sanders says we need to, in order for the Democrats to win, they have to bring back. Thanks, buddy. Hey, thanks, sir. They have to bring the white working class back into the fold of the Democratic Party. There is a theory, and I'm just throwing this out. Okay, hear me out. Perhaps we should extend affirmative action to just besides the historically disenfranchised, to the lower income groups of the whites, working class. Is there any validity to that theory? Would this be acceptable? I was just wondering. Perhaps that would be a way of for these lower-income whites to once again vote Democrat and not feel that they are being cut in front of the line. I'm just wondering about it.
Right. So, yeah, one of the challenges is how do you put forward things that address class and racial disparities? You know, here's the good news is if you provide debt-free college education as a targeted universal, you know, benefit, like the GI Bill after World War II, and if you hyper-target it to first-generation college students who've been excluded, white and black, you all of a sudden have a progressive populist coalition. So I think picking, you know, there are things like that that. And same with first-time homebuyer. You're a first-time homebuyer. You've been excluded from getting on the wealth-building train by inability to purchase a home. You know, think about this. After World War II, we had white affirmative action. You know, we basically we taxed the wealthy and invested in debt-free education, very low-interest mortgages for a generation of mostly white people. And so a lot of people got on the wealth-building train, but not everyone did. And people of color were excluded by that. I have an uncle who got a 40-year, 1% fixed-rate farmer's home mortgage to buy his farm. 40-year, 1% fixed-rate, the Veterans Administration mortgages, the VA mortgage, 35-year, 1% fixed-rate mortgage. Why? There's no reason why we couldn't target those kind of initiatives to those who've been excluded. People of color have been excluded the most from the wealth building train, but there's a generation of other people who've been excluded, and that becomes a targeted universal solution. So the one thing is to realize that not all of those solutions address the underlying drivers of white supremacy. And so there has to be a kind of a racial wealth divide audit to any of these universal programs to ensure that they don't perpetuate or compound the existing historic inequalities. Good question, though.
Gene Berkman from the Unitarian Universalist Society of Burlington, Vermont, and the proud home of Bernard Sanders, our former mayor, who I serve with on the city council. Chuck, you have been traveling this nation on book tour, and this GA is not only about resistance, but about rejoicing. And I believe that we need many stories of hope and success to be able to sustain us, to know that we can do in our own homes what needs to be done with what we've got there. And so I'm wondering whether you could share some stories about your travels and the ways that common folk like us are making a difference in their communities, and perhaps give us some ideas so that we can shamelessly steal them and take them home to our hometowns.
Yeah. Well, as a storyteller, I love to tell stories, and I also know how long they sometimes can take in our time together. I would just say what I have observed is there is a hunger and an awakening in this country for, and I'm talking to generationally, I've been doing it on a lot of college campuses, and the younger generation, first of all, they understand this sort of intersectionality stuff faster. You know, some of what takes an old goat like me decades to figure out, they figure out in about 15 minutes, and they're reflecting it back. So there's like a rising generation that I think will fundamentally transform our culture and our society. And as they step forward, they need us to have their backs. They need resources, they need support, they need, you know, mentoring to build the next generation of social movements. So that's one thing I would just say. I think as somebody who talks to the privileged, to the one percenters, there's also people waiting to be invited to something bigger than consumption. And this is where we want to connect with people on a spirit level and on a meaning level, inviting the wealthy to come home. I mean, that's kind of the message I've had with the 1% is, look, come home. Bring your wealth home. Bring it out of the offshore tax havens and the global financial casino and put it back into the communities. Put a stake in a place. And I guess what I would say is when you think about privileged people, yeah, it, you know, there's a segment of the 1% who use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. But there's also a segment that are like the Patriotic Millionaires and some of these other networks out there pressing for tax fairness, saying raise taxes on people like us. And then there's this huge segment, and this is the group that I'm talking to, which are like, just like the rest of us, what is it I can do? Where can I plug in? And because of the way class and race, white supremacy disconnects people from each other, part of what they're waiting for is to be brought, invited home. So part of our work for the rest of us is find ways to invite people to the table, not at the head of the table, but to the table, to be part of fixing the future. You know, and we're at an interesting moment, which is these inequalities actually are bad for everybody. They undermine stability. They undermine the health of the society. They undermine the life, quality of life for the rich, even though they might be barricading themselves. And if you put that together with the ecological crisis, there is no wealth on a degraded earth. There's no wealth if there's not fresh water. And so I'm finding you can actually say, you know what, it is actually entirely in your deepest self-interest to come home, to bring the wealth home, and to get into the trenches with everyone else and fix the future. And I think that's, I see another kind of a hope and awakening in that area. So I don't have too many stories in that regard, but I've got a couple. Yeah.
Yeah. Sally Gellert, Central Unitarian in Paramus, New Jersey. I'm thinking of the financial industry that has done so much damage. I'm thinking of the recent announcement that Amazon is buying Whole Foods. And this whole consolidation of corporatization and, you know, all that. And I don't know where to go with it, but thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, it'd be a very interesting, you know, think about us UUs. How much money do we spend on Amazon? It'd be an interesting exercise. I mean, I have Amazon Prime. I'm got to have it tomorrow, right? But I actually think, you know, we obviously know the impact Amazon is having, destroying our main streets. And as they expand into other retail, you can just sort of see the little stores close up. So I think, you know, we need to take on that model, because we know that if you're going to go to the Whole Foods in 3 years, they're not going to be human cashiers anymore. They're all about eliminating human labor. So that whole business model, which is not just Amazon, but which is encroaching into almost every sector of the economy, we have to resist it. I mean, it's interesting to me. I was just in Silicon Valley with all these, you know, the disruptors, right? The people who sit around saying, how can we eliminate labor? They actually understand what they're doing on some level and are coming out in support of this idea of a universal basic income to say, hey, look, you know, maybe we should de-link, you know, a living wage from employment. Like, let's go back to 1974, you know, radical ideas like Richard Nixon, family guaranteed income, you know. But they're actually, they understand that the trade-off of that disruption. But it's really up to the rest of us, you know, to you know, I think we should be seriously thinking about, well, how do we engage Amazon as consumers? We vote with our dollars. We vote with our dollars for what kind of system we want. And we cooperate or non-cooperate. And that's an individual moral choice, but it's a collective choice. Our church has a, you know, if you buy a book through our church portal and a nickel goes to Amazon, maybe that's not the right way to go, right? Yeah.
Hi, my name is Frank, and I live in one of the most gerrymandered congressional districts in the country. I think that is the problem. Gerrymandering will likely leave the House in Republican control until 2040. I probably won't live long enough to see a Democratic House. We need to address that first. And it might surprise people to hear, especially my fellow progressives, that I live in Maryland, and I'm talking about the 7th District, one of the most democratically strong districts in the country. So it isn't just a Republican issue. It's both sides of the aisle.
I think, you know, I mean, part of the good news awakening that I'm seeing is people understanding, you know, what's happened to state houses across this country. How do we do progressive populist campaigns in states and localities and essentially rebuild from the bottom up? How many people are here are thinking about running for office? How many people have young people that they're mentoring and supporting to run for office? That's part, and then looking at the maps within states and the way what's happened to state houses and state legislatures. So that's the good news is, you know, 7,000 people are considering running for office who'd never thought about running for office in local jurisdictions, most of them women. So that's part of the shift. Yeah.
My name is Barbara. I'm from the UU Church of Oak Cliff in Dallas, and it's sort of a follow-up to the last question. I think one of the biggest obstacles to solving any number of these problems is the impact of big money on our elections. What do you see as a potentially effective way of limiting the big money and changing our campaign financing?
Well, I mean, there's probably people here who are very active with Move to Amend, who are looking at sort of addressing the Citizens United decision. There's a lot of state intervention, so check out, you know, organizations like Every Voice. The city of Seattle has just piloted a campaign finance voter voucher. So for their city elections, every citizen in the city of Seattle, every registered voter, gets, you know, five $25 vouchers that they can give to the candidates. So there's some interesting experiments in publicly financed elections. Maine just passed instant runoff voting as a kind of voter reform. So these are things that help, you know, kind of rewire democratic operations. It doesn't address the money influence nexus. And this is where I agree. I agree that money and politics is central to the problem, and we have this concentration of wealth and power. How do we address that? I mean, concentrated wealth is like money water rolling down a hill. It's just going to keep finding its way around whatever barrier you put up to influence politics. So in the end, we have to sort of look at things that both tax concentrations of wealth, reduce the concentration, and choke off the nexus between money and influence. But I would start by looking in terms of state and even cities that are trying to experiment with new campaign finance mechanisms. So back to Dick.
Yeah, I wish we had time to hear all the questions, but I know there's incredible knowledge and passion among all of you, and very few of you will have a chance to get up here and express that to Chuck. So gather with three or four neighbors and express that passion and question. Pour out your heart to your neighbors on inequality or Trump or whatever, or listen to your neighbors and learn from them, and so we can energize ourselves. Thank you.
Set that up as sort of an activity.
Yeah.
We're about to wrap up here. If you would like to join UUJC or get more materials about it, go over to our little table over here. And again, Chuck will be doing a book signing at 10:30 tomorrow morning in UUA bookstore. And if you'd like to give us some feedback, again, email uujc@uujc.com. And you can, you're free to continue your conversations for a little while. But some of us will be headed off to the sanctuary action here. Thank you.